Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back. Or if you're new around here, hi, my name's Georgia. And on my platforms here on the internet, I talk about true crime. Sometimes I talk about solved cases. Most of the time I talk about unsolved cases, trying to spread the word of these cases, which are so close to having answers, but just need a little more of a push. The case I have to share with you today is a really heavy one, and I mean everything I cover is pretty heavy, but there's just something about this case which has just been weighing really heavily on my heart. It's just tragic beginning to end. It's a case that shouldn't be unsolved. The family should have answers here, they should have closure, it should have been pretty easy to get them. But 36 years on, we just don't have the answers. In doing my research for this case today, I learned a lot about the Indigenous communities of Australia, something which, being from the UK, I'd never really heard much about. And in doing so, I learned that it's custom across some Australian Aboriginal groups to not mention the names of people who have passed, either during the period of mourning or for much, much longer. So out of respect for those groups, I do just want to mention that the case we're going to be talking about today features the names and images of a dead Indigenous person, a Gomeroi man. Today we're going to be talking about the frustratingly unsolved case of 17-year-old Mark Haynes, whose body was found on the train tracks with a towel folded underneath his head, just outside of his hometown of Tamworth in Australia in 1988. His death was immediately just brushed off by local police as a sort of misadventure. They said it was Mark's fault, but as you'll come to see, even just a very cursory look at the circumstances surrounding this proved that not to be true. Mark did not end up on those train tracks through choice, and very soon we might finally have some new answers thanks to there being another coronial inquest taking a look into this case, which is hopefully going to start very, very soon. So could there finally be some semblance of justice for Mark Haynes on the horizon? Well, I guess we're going to find out. Mark Haynes was a charming and charismatic teenage boy from Tamworth, a city in New South Wales in Australia, about a 5-hour drive north of Sydney. In the 1980s, Tamworth had a population of around 33,000 people, including an Aboriginal population, who mostly tended to live in West Tamworth. This was a town quite literally divided by railway tracks. The white population lived on the east of the tracks, whilst the Aboriginal population lived on the west side in an area called Coaldale. And Mark was one of those in Coaldale. And like in many places, the Indigenous community here in Tamworth dealt with a lot of racism and prejudice. The white population often called Coaldale Vegemite Village for reasons I'm sure are obvious. So the two communities didn't really integrate that well very often, but Mark was always one of the exceptions. He was very easily able to flip between the two. He was, like I said, charming and charismatic, so he was incredibly popular. He was one of those quite annoying people in life who was kind of just good at everything he turned his hand to. Nothing was ever too hard or too difficult for Mark. He was a good student at school, he excelled in cricket and basketball. His loved ones described him as a very happy-go-lucky kind of guy. He was always smiling, he always had friends, he didn't have any enemies or anyone who even disliked him despite being Aboriginal. I mean, I think you can see that even just in photos of Mark. He had this big, cheeky, chappy kind of smile with a very impressive head of hair that I am just incredibly jealous of. And to a lot of his many, many friends, Mark was known by his nickname of Stony, thanks to the way he spoke, in this sort of like slow, gravelly drawl, just like he was always stoned. It was a very endearing nickname, and it's even etched into his headstone. So yeah, Mark Haynes wasn't the kind of guy who would find himself in situations where people didn't like him or would want to hurt him. Everyone liked him. And I know that's what you always hear people say in true crime cases, but in Mark's case, I couldn't find anything to suggest that wasn't true. He was just universally loved. And before I go any further into this episode, I do just want to take a moment to talk about another man, another sort of key character in this story called Alan Clark, without whom I would not be recording this today. Alan's a journalist, he is Aboriginal himself, and he has spent his entire career trying to bring to light the injustices that Aboriginal people across Australia face. And as you'll come to see, the police really didn't bother to investigate Mark's death, and therefore it went under the radar for many, many years. Mark's family were just screaming into the void to try and get somebody to listen to them. And no one really did until Alan took on the case, and now it's become his life's mission to get justice. As Alan has said to CBC, he was just not worthy of police's time or the media's time, as opposed to other young white teenagers who had died in similar circumstances. Their cases elicited a lot of public empathy, a lot of police work to try and figure out what happened to them. I wanted to take Mark's case and basically use that as a way to try and get proof that racism does play a role in these unsolved Aboriginal homicides. So Alan Clark got in contact with Mark's family, particularly Mark's uncle Doug Craigie, and they've embarked on their mission to raise awareness of this story. Alan, for many years alongside Mark's family, has worked tirelessly. Before he came along, nobody knew the name Mark Haynes, but that all changed mostly around 2018 when he released his podcast Blood on the Tracks. It's a two-part deep dive into this case. It features interviews with those surrounding it, and it's pretty much the only reliable source on this case. Pretty much every article I've read online just pulls its information from Blood on the Tracks, because that's all there is. So whilst I'm going to do my best to tell Mark's story in this episode, if you really want to hear it from the horse's mouth, I highly recommend you then go and listen to Blood on the Tracks, and I'll link it down below. Without Alan, we would not know this case. Without Alan, Mark wouldn't hopefully be on the verge of some kind of justice, finally. The Police State Crime Command wouldn't have opened this reinvestigation in 2018 without him. But let's go back in time and talk about the original investigation, or original lack of investigation. It was the summer holidays, and on the evening of Friday the 15th of January 1988, Mark decided to go out with his best friend and cousin, Leah. He was said to be in a very good mood that day. He was very excited for the night ahead of him, with plans to go to a local club called Domino's. Only Mark was only 17 years old, and so in order to get into Domino's, he had to borrow Leah's boyfriend's ID, which is something that so many of us did to get into clubs underage. That part of the night went off without a hitch. He went to the club, he had a good time, he got a bit drunk, and ended up leaving with his girlfriend Tanya and another couple in the early hours of Saturday the 16th. Tanya was a white girl that he'd met at school, and this was a perfect example of Mark being able to sort of seamlessly move between the two communities, and by all accounts they were a very happy couple. At around 3:30 a.m, Mark walks Tanya to the corner of Wilbur Tree and Edward Street, which is kind of right next to her house, and the couple say goodbye. Tanya watches Mark jog up the street in the direction of his home in West Hamworth, and she just assumes he was going straight home. He hadn't said anything that sort of suggested he wasn't going home. And this is where the sort of known timeline of Mark's movements whilst alive that night end. This is all we know for certain. What we have for the rest of the night is kind of a vague timeline pieced together by Alan Clark, using interviews with friends and family and evidence from the first coronial inquest. It's all just guesswork at this point, but probably quite good guesswork. There's about a 3-hour gap here where we don't really know what happened. What we do know is that a local woman would come forward later saying that shortly after the time that Mark left Tanya, so just after 3:30, she was awoken by loud noises, two males arguing loudly out in the street. She describes one of the men as sounding incredibly distressed, somebody sort of like close to the end of their tether, screaming at the other one to leave him alone. The witness said it sounded like somebody was being hurt. She tried to go back to sleep, but then is again woken about 3:40 a.m. when she hears a car flying up the street. She hears a screech of the brakes and then it speeds off again. Now, she just assumed it was young people messing around. She didn't really think much of it until she heard of the circumstances around Mark's death. Another separate witness would later say at the inquest that she was heading home in a taxi after a night out just after 3 a.m. when she sees a car speeding on the wrong side of Wilbur Tree Street. The car she saw was a white Tirana, and hold on to that piece of information. She said that she saw two males in the front seat and a few in the back, and described them all as younger, but in terms of witnesses or between 3:30 and 6 a.m, that's all we really have. And then it was 6:05 a.m. that morning when a driver on a freight train passing through Tamworth made a call to control, saying that he just passed over a body. Now, trains can't really stop or brake quickly when they see an upcoming obstacle on the tracks. By the time they realise there's something there, it's most often too late. So the driver originally saw what he thought was a load of just rags on the track from a distance. As he got closer, he realised it was a body, he put on the emergency brake, but it was too late. All the driver could do was make the call and get somebody else to go and check it out, with the person in question being Tamworth station master Glenn Bryant. Glenn was the first person to arrive on the scene and the first person to see the body on the tracks up close, which would obviously turn out to be Mark. He has since said that he immediately felt like the scene in front of him just didn't make any sense. Mark's head was resting on a double folded towel as if it was being used as a pillow, sort of like in between the rails. Now, I'm about to describe some pretty graphic injuries, something I usually avoid as much as possible, but it's vital for understanding in this case, so needs must. Mark had a massive injury on his hairline. Glenn described his head as looking like a crushed eggshell. There was also a very large gash on his thigh. But despite having been seemingly run over by a literal train, there was no blood at the scene. You'd expect blood and matter and tissue to be everywhere, but the tracks and the surrounding area were clean. The only blood found at the scene was a small spot about the size of a 50-cent coin. That was it. Glenn said that whilst in his position as station master, he's seen every kind of injury possible on the railways. You can imagine the kind of scenes that come out of people being hit by trains. But he had never seen anything like this one. He has since said that thanks to the distinct lack of blood, he believes that Mark was already dead before the train hit him. Somebody placed him there to make it look like a suicide. That was his sort of like immediate response to this scene. If he died as a result of this train, there would have been blood everywhere, and the lack of blood suggested that Mark's heart had already stopped pumping by the time he was hit. Glenn would also mention how at one point he looked down at his own feet and noticed that his shoes were covered in mud. It's probably quite important to mention at this point that it had been quite rainy the night before, like not torrential downpours, but rainy enough to cause quite a bit of mud. So Glenn looked at his own feet and then looked at Mark's and realised that Mark's shoes were inexplicably clean. There was no way that he'd walked to this part of the tracks himself without getting covered in mud. But Glenn was an investigator, he was just a station master, and police would be the ones to solve this crime, he thought. That wasn't his place. And it wasn't long until the police arrived at the scene, where they remained for just 1 hour before deciding they had everything they needed. Mark's body was quickly taken away, they cleared up, and they just left, with little to zero investigation being done at the scene. They just kind of assumed immediately that this was either a case of suicide or misadventure. Either way, it was Mark's fault. This wasn't a crime scene, they could just pack up and go. And this is pretty indicative of the way this entire investigation would go. It really just wouldn't get any better from this point. This is probably a good time to talk about the police treatment of the Aboriginal community in Australia as a whole. And of course, this isn't something that I have experienced firsthand. I've never even been to Australia. So once again, we're going to be leaning on the words and the experience of Alan Clark to get this point across. In August 2020, he wrote an article for the Global Investigative Journalism Network in which he writes about how heavy his work has weighed on him. Aboriginal people make up just over 3% of the Australian population, yet they make up a disproportionate amount of the people in the prison and juvenile justice system. The hard truth that Alan came to realise was that people outside of this community just didn't care about Mark and his death because he was a black teenager, something he's seen over and over again throughout the years. Since 1991, there have been at least 432 Aboriginal deaths in police custody, a number which just continues to climb, and no one has ever been convicted of these deaths. When breaking the law, no matter how small that law is, Aboriginal people are found to face disproportionate violence from the police. The police are more likely to use force when dealing with black individuals versus white, something we do see all over the world. Australia is a country built on colonialism, a country built on displacing Indigenous people. And that's something that's reflected in their current system, not just by the police, but by the justice system as a whole and by the media. This is directly reflected in the treatment of Mark's case. It's infuriating. And so far, I've only scratched the surface. So as I said, the police spent about an hour at the crime scene, they removed Mark's body, and then they left, going to inform his family. Several members of the family were actually at an amusement park near Sydney that morning, and they heard their names over the tannoy. When they got to the park's office, they found two officers waiting for them, informing them of what had happened. Mark's parents and sister lived in Penrith, which is about a 5-hour drive from Tamworth, and they opened the door that morning to police officers. At the time of his death, Mark was living in Tamworth with his uncle Ducky and his cousins, not with his parents in Penrith. And I'm not entirely sure what the dynamic was here, but there was nothing really negative, nothing bad had happened. Mark just lived with his uncle Ducky. He loved living with him, he loved his cousins. Everyone was happy. Immediately after hearing the news, everyone jumped in their cars and headed straight up to Tamworth, assuming that they were going to be part of a big police investigation. In the early days here, Mark's family did just assume that a proper investigation would be conducted. I mean, that is what you assume, isn't it? Like, a crime has taken place, somebody has died, the police investigate it. They assumed they'd get answers. But they realised pretty quickly that the police just weren't looking into this, and so they decided to take matters into their own hands. They'd already wandered up to the train tracks at one point in the early days, and they noticed a lot of things at the scene. They saw a pink lighter, a black hair comb, loads of presents scattered nearby, and remnants of a white cardboard box. Now, when they first wandered up there, they didn't touch anything, assuming the police would be coming back for it. But when it became very clear that they weren't, after a number of weeks, the family took matters into their own hands and bagged up the evidence at the scene themselves. They then took all this evidence to the police station and just handed it over to them, with the police saying that they thought they'd already placed these things in the evidence bag. That was it. They just thought they already had this stuff. All this stuff that was at the scene, they thought they already had it, but they didn't. Like, what happened here? Did it fall out of the bag? It's just insanity. And it turns out this sort of like immediate crime scene wasn't the only thing the police had completely failed to investigate, because the body wasn't the only odd thing the train driver reported on his route that morning. Alongside Mark, he also mentioned a crashed car nearby, about 1.5 kilometres away. Now, initially, investigators dismissed any idea that this car and Mark were linked, and so they just left it untouched at the scene. But this car was a white Tirana, the same one a witness saw being driven around by young boys around 3 a.m. The car was sitting in long grass beside Wall Road and the train track, and it was not in a good way. The windscreen was gone, it was just lying on the ground next to the car had clearly rolled, it was all scratched up, and it was wet from the rain overnight. And the police didn't look at it at all. So the family also decided to take a closer look at the Tirana, which was still in the spot where it crashed a week later. As I said, investigators didn't look at this at all first. They didn't fingerprint the car, or they didn't even look inside. They simply said there wouldn't be any point because it was too wet. Any evidence would have washed away. But upon just taking a very quick look at the car, the family found that the police had never even so much as opened the car's boot, because upon doing so, they found a tyre and a mat, both of which were seemingly bloodstained. When they took this to the police, they said it was probably just animal blood, and that was it. The family decide they're going to take the car and put it in storage themselves and just sort of save up to get it checked out for fingerprints. But then, as soon as they decide to do this, the car just disappears. The police had finally taken it and returned it to its owner, from whom it had been stolen. Coincidence? I'll let you decide. It's around this time that the police came up with their sort of like newest theory, the theory that they stuck to for many, many years, and now they decided the car was involved. They told Mark's family that Mark had probably stolen the car and crashed it. The crash caused him to become confused and disorientated, and he got out. He wandered down the train track to the point where he was found, where he decided to lay down and fall asleep, using a towel as a pillow. There are so many questions I have about this theory of the police's, but the first thing that came to my mind was, why on earth would Mark have a towel with him? But the first thing that came to friends and family's mind was the fact that Mark couldn't drive. This was a known fact about him, something that the police easily could have found out if they spoke to literally anyone who knew him, because this was actually a bit of a sore spot for Mark that he just couldn't figure out. And the white Tirana was a manual. It wasn't even an automatic car, it was a manual. There was zero chance that Mark was going to be able to steal this car and drive it. Mark's best friend, Jason, has actually said that just a few weeks before Mark died, he had actually tried to teach Mark how to drive, and he epically failed. Mark kept stalling the car, it was just hopping along, he couldn't figure it out for the life of him. Mark did not steal this white Tirana, he didn't drive it, and he did not crash it. But that was the police's theory, and they stuck with it no matter what. And the car thing is far from the only issue here, because for Mark to have walked from where the car crashed to the point where he was found, he would have had to walk over a very questionable railway bridge with no railing, in the dark, whilst drunk, and possibly injured and disorientated. Some of Mark's family members have tried to do this 1.5 kilometre walk themselves in the weeks after to see just how possible it was, and they figured it just wouldn't have been possible. He couldn't have made this walk. This tiny bit of railway was just like over this sort of very steep drop. It was like, it's not even a bridge, it's literally just a railway going over like a drop. It's like a bridge, but there's no rails. It's not meant for humans to walk on. It is highly, highly dangerous. Somebody trying to do it sober in the daylight is probably going to fall, let alone doing it at night in the dark whilst drunk and possibly injured. Did that change the police's mind though? No, of course, but the police's theory was racially biased. Mark's a young Aboriginal boy. Of course, in their minds, he was out committing crimes. He was out for a joyride, drunk. That's what young Aboriginal boys did. And they weren't willing to look past that. This is the danger of racial biases, of systemic, deeply rooted racism. These police officers probably weren't blatantly thinking like, oh, we'll just dismiss this because he's Aboriginal. This case doesn't matter because he's Aboriginal. That's not what they were thinking, but that's just the result of society as a whole. It's ingrained. It's deeply buried inside your brain. At the end of January, Mark was buried as according to his community's customs, and Uncle Duck Craigie made a promise to Mark's parents, Ron and Josie, that he was going to get justice. And as promised, he is still following through on this to this very day, 36 years later. Over the next few years, both Ron and Josie would die themselves of what their family have called broken hearts. Josie died in her 40s whilst Ron would drink himself to death. 1988 continues on after Mark's burial, and the family are keeping an ear out for any clues that could give them answers. As things generally tend to do in small communities, rumours flew around, including one about Mark being killed in a drug plot. The rumour was that Mark and some of his friends had been plotting to steal marijuana crops from a plot just outside the town, and the drug lords found out about this. Tamworth was a place with a very deep drug issue. There are a lot of people around involved in this kind of thing. It was known that drug leaders would kill people for stealing their crops, for stealing their drugs. It was all just a very violent environment. So did Mark plot to steal some crops? The leaders heard and then they sent out a hit on him. Maybe they just intended to scare him and it went too far. Well, I think it's incredibly unlikely because Mark just wasn't that kind of kid. He'd never once been in trouble with the law before, and whilst he did smoke occasionally, most teenagers around Tamworth did, he wasn't a hardcore drug user, not enough to want to steal crops. There's never been any hard evidence that this is something that Mark was planning. It's all just rumours. Two teenagers did make a statement to the police at one point about this. They said they'd heard rumours at a party that a man called Eddie was a muscle for hire, and he was the one responsible for Mark's death after being hired by the drug lords. Eddie has since spoken out about this accusation. Alan Clark interviewed him for Blood on the Tracks, and he's denied all involvement in Mark's death. But just generally around this town at this time, he was known to be somebody you just didn't mess with. He was an up-and-coming boxer. You don't mess with boxers. But Uncle Ducky heard Eddie's name linked with Mark's death, and this became a highly stressful situation for everyone involved. Mark's family were devastated and grief can make people act out. And so, of course, one day, Duck and his brother come across Eddie outside a pub and they confront him. Both sides here have a different version of what happened next. Eddie says he was physically attacked by Uncle Ducky. Duck denies doing such a thing. He says it was just a verbal altercation. But things just weren't really good. Tensions were high. Mark's uncles are out there just trying to get answers as to the nephew's death, no matter what. Eddie, to this day, vehemently denied the rumours of having any involvement, and they say they ruined his life. And no wonder, being accused of murder, even just in the public opinion, is a really horrible thing. And if you're asking for my personal opinion, it does seem he's telling the truth. He said he never even knew of Mark, he'd never heard of him, and Alan Clark's not been able to find a single link between the two. There is nothing backing up this drug theory. And this is what happens when there's no official investigation happening. The public make up their own theories, their own opinions, and vigilante justice becomes the only way to approach things. Eddie himself has said he doesn't blame Duck for his actions. He was just grieving. He just wanted justice for his nephew. And even Eddie has blamed the police for their actions, or lack thereof. It wasn't until October 1988 that the coronial inquest into Mark's death would finally begin, and the family hoped that with the inquest, the truth would finally come out. They hoped it would prove that Mark had been murdered, or at least somebody else was involved in his death. They knew he hadn't taken his own life on the tracks. But of course, that is not what happened. All that happened was that it became abundantly clear just how much the police had bungled this investigation. The inquest was told that all the evidence the police collected at the scene subsequently fell out of the evidence bag. How does that even happen? This led to Mark's family finding it and taking it in at a later date, but already the evidence has been tainted. The jury is out as to whether we believe they even bothered to collect the evidence at all, and they're just trying to cover their backs here. And then the inquest was also told that the police did not have the white towel in evidence, the towel that Mark's head was found lying on in between the tracks. At one point, somebody had put this white towel on an ambulance stretcher as they sort of removed Mark's body, and then it's kind of just assumed a member of the medical staff might have discarded of it, not thinking anything of it. It was just a towel to them. If it was important, the police would have bagged it. And the towel has never been seen since, which is possibly the most important piece of evidence at this scene. It probably went in a biohazard bag and went into a dump somewhere, and that's it. It will never be seen again. They heard that the car, the Tirana, had a link to one of Mark's friends that he'd been hanging out with that night. It belonged to a boss of one of the boys. The boss had called the police to report his car as missing about 20 minutes after they got the call about Mark on the train tracks. And the boss, it turns out, lived just a number of blocks away from where Mark and Tanya said goodbye that night. In the boot of the car, the boss said they had a number of gifts that he'd been keeping in a white box. He also said that there was a pillow in there as well. At the train tracks, Mark's family had found a number of wrapped gifts, remnants of a white box, and a pillow. So it seems that people weren't wrong in thinking that the car and the scene at the tracks were definitely linked. But Mark hadn't walked to that spot from the crashed car. It's not like he would have carried this whole box of presents with him from the boot. Also, if he was going to be laying down on the tracks for whatever reason, why would he choose to rest his head on a towel when a pillow is right there? But I want to bring your attention back to the white box the presents were kept in, because it would come out at inquest that 6:05 a.m. may not have been the first time that Mark's body was seen on the tracks. About an hour and 15 minutes before that point, a train was coming into Tamworth with a crew, and they spotted a large white box on the tracks. Of course, a train isn't going to stop for a cardboard box on the tracks, so it just plows through and hits it. But the crew would later report that it didn't sound like an empty box. It was kind of a dull thud when they hit it, like something was inside. It would be the same crew on both legs of this journey, and on the return journey they noted that the white box was gone, and in the same spot was simply now Mark's body. The driver has said he distinctly remembers this. The general theory surrounding this is that the white box, which was originally holding presents in the boot of the Tirana, was placed over the top of Mark's body to disguise it from oncoming trains. It worked the first time, but then the box was destroyed by the passing train, leaving Mark's body now out to the open. My only question surrounding this was that if Mark's body was literally run over by a train twice, surely his body would be a lot more damaged than just a couple of deep gashes and a head injury. Like, I'm picturing cut off limbs and all sorts. But perhaps Mark sat between the tracks rather than on them. Perhaps the train sort of passed over the top of him than directly like on his body, if that makes sense. But what the white box on top of the body tells us is somebody placed this on top of Mark to disguise him. He wouldn't have done this himself. You don't lie down on a train track and then cover yourself with a white box. You just don't. After a couple of sessions, the inquest ended and they recorded an open verdict. This wasn't quite what the family wanted, but it also wasn't the worst possible verdict. It just meant the judge didn't agree with the police that it was this easy open and shut case that Mark had laid himself down on the tracks, but it also wasn't anything solid to say that other people were definitely involved. It is clear though that the judge did kind of gloss over a lot of the very glaring inconsistencies in this case. The police said there was no blood at the scene because the rain washed it away, but the rain wasn't that heavy. There was no explanation as to how Mark got to this spot on his own. There was no admonishment for the lack of evidence collected. In fact, the whole of the very poor investigation was kind of just ignored, and to top it off, they barely even looked at Mark's autopsy report, because if they did, they would have seen what was possibly the most damning piece of evidence in this case. And after the inquest, the case just goes cold for 25 years. There were no answers. Nobody apart from Mark's family were even looking for answers. Mark's family at worst thought this was a murder. At best, it was an accidental death that somebody had tried to cover up. But this clearly wasn't Mark's own choice. They knew this. But then Alan Clark heard about the case, he spoke to Uncle Ducky, and he's been on his mission ever since. He read through all of the transcripts from the inquest and got hold of the autopsy report, spotting something which changed the entire timeline of this case. The autopsy report showed that Mark had suffered a subdural hematoma, which was about 1 centimetre in size. For those of you who don't spend every spare waking moment watching Grey's Anatomy on repeat, a subdural hematoma is a type of bleeding in the brain that happens after a head injury. It's caused by a blood vessel tearing, and blood then collects under the dura mater, one of the layers of tissue which protects your brain. And this is a traumatic brain injury. If you don't seek medical attention very quickly for a subdural hematoma, they can be very fatal, but the problem is, you often don't know you've got one until it's too late. According to the Cleveland Clinic, head injuries are the biggest cause of subdural hematomas. Falling and hitting your head whilst playing sports, getting physically assaulted, or taking a blow to your head in a car crash. Like maybe being in a car crash and hitting your head on a windscreen with enough force to pop it out. Alan Clark spotted this and took the information to a Sydney forensic pathologist called Professor Johan de Flew. And analysing what was available, he said a subdural hematoma like this one usually takes hours to develop. They don't develop within seconds and kill you. They take a long time to form. Mark would have survived for a period of time after this injury, maybe hours, maybe less, but he was already injured by the time he ended up on that railway, most likely already dead. Another very damning piece of evidence that at autopsy his organs were found to be pale, indicating a severe lack of blood in his body. So Mark had bled out somewhere, and we know it wasn't at the railway. All that was found at the railway was a tiny, small spot of blood. But there was a lot of blood found in the back of that Tirana. So the theory that kind of makes the most sense here is that Mark ended up in a car crash that night after leaving Tanya at 3:30 a.m. Perhaps his friends came across him in a stolen car, he jumped in, deciding to go along for a ride. But we know he wouldn't have been the one driving. The car crashed and he received a head injury. He likely didn't die instantly, there was time for the subdural hematoma to form. He may have even regained consciousness and been okay for a period of time, although he was likely bleeding a lot. And then he would have gone down. The hematoma was very likely the cause of Mark's death and nothing else, and he did not receive this hematoma at the train tracks. If you're hit by a train, you are very likely dying instantly. You are not having time for a hematoma to form before you die. You are out, you are gone. Now, it could be argued that when he regained consciousness, he was confused and disorientated, and then he decided to wander down to the railway track on his own, and then he decided to lay down on the tracks. But this was still a 1.5 kilometre walk over a very dangerous railway bridge that he would undoubtedly have fallen off of in his state. It just doesn't make sense. Also, the presents were there, the white box. Did he get out of the car and decide to take these presents and the white box and the pillow to the spot where he'd later be found? Why would he walk 1.5 kilometres carrying these presents that weren't even his? The car at some point was closer to that railway track, I would bet. Maybe we'd have more answers for sure if the car had been forensically tested, or if the police had just done any investigation at all. Maybe. The 30th anniversary of Mark's death came around in 2018, along with a huge amount of renewed interest in this case thanks to Alan Clark's coverage and efforts to get Mark's name out in the open. Just a few weeks before this point, the family had heard from the court that they actually still had some of Mark's tissue samples from his organs held in evidence, which nobody knew they had. And this was kind of a huge blow to them because in Gomeroi culture, bodies have to be buried whole on their cultural land. You can't fully rest in peace if all of you isn't on country. You'll always just kind of be waiting in purgatory. I don't know if purgatory is the word they would use, but sort of in the in-between. For 3 decades now, the family had thought Mark was buried whole, they thought he was at peace, and now they find out he wasn't. It was kind of just a slap in the face on top of everything else that had happened. But at this point, the samples were released to them and they held a ceremony for the rest of the remains before burying them with Mark's body. And hopefully, finally now, he is in peace. And around this same time, the police also announced a $500,000 reward for any information in Mark's death. Again, this was something huge finally happening in this case. Money talks in a way that a lot of people's consciousnesses just don't. And it does seem like this renewed interest in more recent years has prompted some local people to open up with what they know. One of these being a woman called Faye Souter, who spoke to Alan in 2013. Faye had a son called Terry. He was apparently very good friends with Mark at the time of his death. And then 6 months later, Terry took his own life at age 19, just leaving a note to his family reading, "Love you all, but can't handle life. Love, Terry." Faye believes with all of her heart that Terry was involved in Mark's death and couldn't live with himself in the aftermath, that the guilt was overwhelming. She thinks that on the night in question, Mark and Terry were with a number of friends driving around in cars, one of which Terry was driving. She believes that he crashed the car and caused Mark's death, and he was subsequently involved in the dumping of Mark's body on the tracks. And this isn't just a story that she's plucked out of nowhere, it's a story that actually comes from her younger son, Terry's younger brother, Mick. Alan Clark spoke to Mick for the first time for the Blood on the Tracks podcast, and that was the first time Mick ever went on record with his story. And the story is this. On the morning of Saturday the 16th of January 1988, he was 14 years old and he's fast asleep when he's woken up by his big brother Terry. The following events would traumatise him so deeply that he only has flashes of memory, but he remembers being at the train tracks with his brother. Mick asked Terry what they were doing there, to which Terry just responded, "Just fucking wait here or I'll clout you over the ear," as siblings do. But Mick was a curious teenager. He followed and ended up seeing Mark's body. He's always believed that he saw Terry put his own red jacket under Mark's head that night. But as we know, there was no red jacket under his head or found anywhere at the scene, just a white towel. We all know that memory is a very funny thing, and traumatic memories are like trying to grab onto smoke sometimes. But Mick is the only person to ever admit to seeing Mark's body on the tracks, and he thinks his brother ended his life out of guilt. He thinks he placed a towel, a jacket, something under Mark's head through guilt. They don't think that Terry purposefully killed Mark, or if it wasn't Terry, the theory isn't that anyone purposefully killed Mark. The prevailing theory in this case is a car crash. A bunch of teenage boys being teenage boys, making bad choices, living life on the edge, and bad things happening. When Mark ends up dying, they panic, and instead of just facing up to their own actions, a lack of fully functioning frontal lobe leads them to make stupid decisions to try and cover up the death. Somebody had the idea to put him on the train tracks, maybe assuming the body would be so destroyed that they just wouldn't be able to figure out what happened, and they go with it. They're teenagers, they're making stupid decisions. Maybe they hoped that people would assume that Mark had taken his own life. And as soon as this was done, they were in too deep. They were never able to come forward and admit to what they did. And now they're adults with families to support. They've got away with it for this long, so why would they come forward now? This is a theory, remember, but it seems to make sense with what we currently know. Faye believes that two cars were involved, the stolen Tirana and Terry's own car. She believes they were joyriding on the wet roads and an accident happened. It was stupid decisions. They didn't mean for somebody to die, but Mark did. And then they couldn't admit to it. Mark's best friend Jason has also said very similar to Alan Clark. Jason said that one day, about a decade ago, he was at home when an old friend, a woman he knew, turned up at his house. She said that one of Mark's friends had confessed to her that he was there when Mark died, and she didn't know what to do with this information. The friend had got drunk and confessed that he put Mark's body on the tracks. She thought there was sort of some kind of car accident involved. Apparently, she also gave Jason a load of details that nobody really knew at this point, including details of a white box on his body. And the pair decided to call Crime Stoppers with the information that they had, but they never heard anything back. Police have since said they have no record of this information, and the friend, not the female friend, the friend who confessed to her, has denied this entire story. Faye also attempted to go to the police with her information as well over the years, but she was continually brushed off. They just didn't seem to care or want to solve Mark's case. And then Alan came along, and then New South Wales Greens MP David Shoebridge heard about this case, and he was shocked that such a blatant lack of justice had taken place for Mark, and he got involved, confronting the police himself. David agreed with the thoughts of the rest. If Mark was a white boy instead of Aboriginal, this case never would have gone unsolved. Police would have found out what was really happening. Teaming up with Alan and Dark, the three of them fought to get Mark's case back in front of the New South Wales Coroner's Court. And in the end, they finally got the police to listen to Faye's story. And on the back of that, Mark's case was finally reopened. But that wasn't really enough, because the local police hadn't looked at it properly the first time, so what faith did they have in them now? Like, uncovering anything new was just going to look bad on them, so what motivation did they have? So David Shoebridge returned to state parliament and lobbied to have the case given to the elite State Crime Command's homicide squad, who are like the big guns. On top of that, the State Crime Command also took on a full review of the original investigations into Mark's death, something which concluded 2 years ago now in February 2022. The information was sent to the State Coroner for consideration. And then just last year, in 2023, the reward was doubled to $1 million. At the time of the increase, Oxley Police District Commander Detective Acting Superintendent Jason Darcy said, "Mark's family deserve closure and peace, having dealt with uncertainty of what happened over 3 decades ago. The case remains open, and any information that comes to light will be given the highest priority and fully investigated. We believe there are people in the community who have vital information on Mark's disappearance and know exactly what happened to him on that night. Any information, no matter how small you may think it is, could be the missing piece to the puzzle." Shortly before this, a fresh inquest had also been announced, which is due to begin in April of this year, 2024. Finally, after 36 years, we might be about to get some answers in this case. I'm very intrigued to see what comes out of this inquest, but bear in mind it is just an inquest, it's not a criminal trial. No one is going to end up in prison at the end of this, but it might provide Mark's family with some clearer answers. On Mark's gravestone is written that he mysteriously died, and Uncle Duck wants to be able to remove the mysterious. He just wants to know what happened. And now, with a new inquest, law enforcement are properly looking into this case. Oxley Police District Detective Inspector Jason Darcy has said that persons of interest have now been identified in this case, but at this point there's insufficient evidence to go to the next stage of a legal process, which is why the second inquest is going to be invaluable. Maybe it will uncover some evidence that could be used in legal proceedings going forward, but at the very least, hopefully it will just provide some answers to the family, who now also have the full backing of the National Justice Project behind them, who are huge. Their solicitor, Katrina Hawtrey, has said, "The New South Wales coroner has the power to investigate not only the cause of Mr. Haynes' death, but also to expose the inadequacies in New South Wales police's investigations. The failure to adequately investigate Mr. Haynes' death was not just an isolated misstep by one police station. It was evidence of a systemic failure by New South Wales police to handle Indigenous deaths the same way as non-Indigenous deaths." They're hoping that by reopening this case, reopening the inquest, they can set a precedent for similar Aboriginal cases all over the country. Because Mark's story is just one of many. You see the same thing happening across the country to so many families. I mean, Mark wasn't even the only Aboriginal boy found on or near the railway tracks in odd circumstances. There's also Stephen Smith, Buddy Kelly, plus at least a fourth unnamed boy. These cases aren't necessarily linked, although who can say for definite, but they do underline huge inadequacies by law enforcement. They were all brushed off, all ignored. So now we just wait and see what the new coronial inquest uncovers, see if it could potentially lead to actual legal proceedings. I hope more than anything that the family are finally going to get some answers here. I hope they're able to provide a more reasonable explanation based on the subdural hematoma and the huge lack of blood. To me, they're the glaring anomalies in this case, the two things that point to something more happening. Mark did not end up on those railway tracks by choice, and I will be sure to update you when the inquest has finished. If you have any information though that could help in this case, you can contact Australia's Crime Stoppers, whether by phone or online. I'll leave the information in the description box down below as always. Remember, there is a $1 million reward for any information, and anything provided will be treated in the strictest of confidence. If you've watched this one all the way to the end, I know this has been a longer episode, and thank you so much for sticking around. As I said, I will be sure to update you all when the inquest is finished. I'll let you know exactly what comes of that. Hopefully it will be something, an answer for Mark's family. In a dream world, it will lead to maybe a conviction, but we'll see. There'll still be a long process after that point. As I said, the inquest is just civil, it is not criminal. If you want to hear the updates from me, then make sure you subscribe to this channel so you can see them as they happen. Or if you're listening to this by my podcast, just make sure you follow the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and then you'll get notified whenever there's a new episode. Again, thank you so much, and I will see you in the next one. Bye, guys.